A week ago, out of nowhere, Donald Trump signalled that the United States would, after 30-something years, resume nuclear testing. Other US officials have walked that back a bit, but it comes as an unhappy reminder that nuclear weapons remain one of the most urgent unsolved problems of the world. As Gareth Evans writes in the latest issue of Australian Foreign Affairs, the outlook ranges from desolate to hopeless. The important arms control agreements of the past are dead, dying, or on life support. And the recent behaviour of the actors that matter most, the United States, Russia, and China, has fed concerns that things can only get worse. Post-Parliament, Gareth Evans has spent much of his energies campaigning to avert nuclear catastrophe, first as President and CEO of the Brussels-based International Crisis Group, lately as the founding convener of the Asia-Pacific Leadership Network for Nuclear Non-Proliferation and Disarmament. He has also continued to write on the subject, and the paper that he's just published in Australian Foreign Affairs is called Doomsday Diplomacy: Australia Can Lead a New Arms Control Push. Gareth joins me from Melbourne. Gareth, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, David.
Is there still a thing called the Doomsday Clock, and are they still adjusting it? And if so, where are we?
Well, it's the rhetorical device employed by the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists, and it's now, I think, I've forgotten how many seconds to midnight, but it's the closest to midnight that it's been since the clock was originally set several decades ago. And that reflects the reality that after a period of some confidence that we were moving away from the crazy arms racing of the Cold War years to a more sober appreciation of the problems of nuclear weapons, it reflects the reality that we now have a situation where, as you said in your intro, all the existing and familiar arms control, nuclear arms control agreements of recent decades are either dead or dying or on life support, and where we've got the major nuclear players all engaged in outright increases in their stockpiles, particularly in the case of China, or significant modernization of them. Plus, you've got a situation where recently in the context of Ukraine, Putin's made it pretty clear that he doesn't feel as constrained as he might, as others might have in the past, with the nuclear taboo, so-called, and does see the possibility of the actual use, not just the threat of use of nuclear weapons. And in a context where all this is happening, and our various intelligence and defence agencies and some of those who drink similar Kool-Aid getting very excited about potential threats from China in particular, the risks of all this turning pear-shaped are pretty significant.
Why has this drift back to nuclear renewal, why has that happened? Surely, essentially, the world was very happy with the notion that the puff had gone out of all of this nuclear confrontation.
Well, I feel there's a sort of complacency that having lived for 80 years without it happening, despite so many reminders from so many people that it could happen, there's just a degree of complacency that this is just a doomsday scenario that's not, might be theoretically possible, but is not actually going to happen. And I think in that context, it's very easy to stumble into a kind of indifference to the need to be constantly pursuing either, if not outright elimination, certainly effective non-proliferation and certainly nuclear risk reduction. There just doesn't seem to be the same kind of momentum. We haven't had the leadership we need also from critical leaders. You did have it to some extent from Obama and Biden, who seem to recognise the problem and the need to do something about it. But now, of course, with Trump, who's all over the place, as you began by saying, even with this extraordinary recent opening up again of the option of possible nuclear testing, you've got American leadership all over the place. You've got the Russians, as I've said, actively undermining or degrading the nuclear taboo. And you've got the Chinese, pursuing nuclear build-up, not, I think, with any particular aggressive intent, more defensive, but nonetheless creating an environment in which it seems that, you know, most bets are off. You've got Israel still pretending not to have any nuclear weapons at all and behaving very badly in so many other ways, as we know. You've got India and Pakistan constantly on the brink of further conflict with, you know, real concern that nuclear weapons might be deployed, but somehow it just doesn't seem to have caught the popular imagination, the political imagination.
Let's go to the absolute basic of this. Surely anybody knows that if they push the button to send a nuclear weapon across the world, they are committing suicide.
I think that's the reality, and that's why I say that most of the really extreme scenarios of latter-day Strangelove, or Kim Jong-il in Korea actually pressing the button and initiating an aggressive first use, I think that is implausible. But it's also the reason why most of the arguments for the necessity of having nuclear weapons as a deterrent, for example, vulnerable states without nuclear weapons now feeling that they need them in order to beat off the possibility of some regime-changing assault from a nuclear weapons power. I mean, that's where your point, becomes very relevant indeed. If a Ukraine had kept its nuclear weapons rather than giving them up at the end of the Cold War, would it be remotely credible for Ukraine to be using them in the context of resisting the Russian cross-border aggression? No, because to do so would be manifestly suicidal. If North Korea were to use nuclear weapons from the handful that it has in its present stockpile against South Korea or anybody else, I mean, it would be reduced, if not by nuclear weapons, then certainly by the conventional capability of the United States and others. I mean, Pyongyang would be reduced to a car park within 5 minutes. And it is a suicidal enterprise, and it's crazy under those circumstances to believe that there's any real rational utility in retaining these things, particularly when the risk of just having them just through misreading of an emerging situation or system error or human error, miscalculation, misjudgment, moving into a full-scale nuclear exchange, which would, of course, have not only catastrophic humanitarian consequences, because these are the most indiscriminately inhumane weapons ever devised, but also catastrophic consequences for the planet and life on the planet as we know it. So it's really, really important just to keep people's minds concentrated on what the real issue is here and not to get carried away by the spurious psychological comfort that nuclear weapons or the prospect of acquiring nuclear weapons seems to give so many people in high office.
Another drawback with nuclear weapons, surely, is that you can't use them nearby. And for Putin to say, look, we might drop a bomb on Ukraine, is just manifestly ridiculous, because the wind will blow all the shit back on Russia. Ditto, Israel can't drop a nuclear bomb on any neighbour of theirs. They can't drop a nuclear bomb on Gaza.
No, that's absolutely right. And that's, again, one of the rational reasons why the whole enterprise is sort of nonsensical. I mean, the whole thing is just crafted on the notion, I suppose, that even if these things are never used, the possession of them is some kind of effective deterrent. But weapons that are not actually usable for the reasons we've just been talking about, what sort of deterrent does that actually amount to? The post-Cold War, recent decades have been littered with instances of non-nuclear states actually attacking nuclear states, and the Falklands War and Korean Wars, Vietnam Wars and so on, without any real belief that there would be nuclear consequences by doing so. The whole thing is a sort of an illusion piled upon an illusion piled upon an illusion. But it's not a harmless illusion. It's a very dangerous illusion because of the prospects of things careering very rapidly out of control. And this notion of the potential for accidental use is not just academic or pretense. I mean, I can identify, if we had time, a dozen instances.
Well, let's explore a few of them, because when I read your essay, they really alarmed me.
Yeah, well, I mean, during the Cold War years, you had the classic situation of the Cuban missile contest in the early 60s, when it was only the fact of the happenstance presence of a third senior Soviet official on a submarine in Caribbean waters that stopped them responding to a perceived attack on that submarine with a nuclear torpedo, thus triggering World War III. There was that situation, but then we've had alarms of incoming missile barrages being triggered in the United States by a military exercise tape being mistakenly fed into the live warning system. That was in 1979. We had the failure of a single computer chip generating an impression of a nuclear nuclear invasion in 1980, twice in that year. We had in the Soviet Union in 83, officials misreading sunlight on high altitude clouds as being evidence of a nuclear launch. And in the post-Cold War years, it still continued. In 1995, Yeltsin in Russia was advised to retaliate immediately against an incoming NATO missile, which proved to be a Norwegian scientific rocket. 2007, you had the craziness Well, it just goes on and on and on. You had the, you know, six nuclear weapons being loaded by the US into a plane on the tarmac somewhere in the US, and people not realizing that it happened. It was flying around the country for 6 days without anyone noticing.
And left overnight unguarded on a an airstrip somewhere.
And then you had 2022, an Indian missile crashing into Pakistani territory, the result of human error by a launch crew. But in the absence of any effective hotline communication between military leaders, triggering a high alert response, which could easily have gone totally nuclear pear-shaped. And again, there's another similar instance earlier just this year. So year after year after year, case after case after case, you've got this hard evidence of being absolutely on a knife edge in terms of things, you know, potentially going pear-shaped, and it being a matter of, as I keep writing, sheer dumb luck, not human sense or system sense, but sheer dumb luck that we've avoided that catastrophe.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Gareth Evans about the essay he's just published in Australian Foreign Affairs. Gareth, you argue that the existence of nuclear weapons actually encourages the build-up of conventional weapons. Now, have I got that right?
Well, I'm just saying it doesn't guarantee that that won't happen. And there is a, you know, there's an argument that the presence of nuclear weapons makes the world safe for conventional war, because the nature of triggering a nuclear response is so extreme and so unlikely because of the respective consequences for both sides, that gives, you know, potential players the opportunity and the excuse to be very creatively antagonistic without using nuclear weapons. And some, you know, the Kargil case in India and a whole bunch of the ones that I've already mentioned in passing involve people playing war games with each other in the expectation that they can go a long way in generating military kinetic results without triggering a nuclear response from the other side. So I'm not saying that nuclear weapons encourage the build-up of conventional weapons, but they certainly don't ensure that conventional weapons won't be used. If anything, the contrary has shown to be the case in recent decades.
Is it clear who in the United States would press the button?
Well, it remains the president. That decision is his. One can only hope that in a situation of potential craziness by the president, or impulsiveness or overreaction or whatever, that cooler military heads around him would somehow, you know, find it possible to either ignore or countermand such an order coming down. But it's a very fragile basis on which to vest your hopes. And when you've got people in office as impulsive and as ignorant and as indifferent to, you know, rational advice as someone like Trump currently in the White House, the guarantee that in the short decision frame that would be involved in the event of a perceived evidence of an incoming nuclear attack, the notion that in the very short time window involved you'd get a completely rational, you know, response is something to be optimistic about, but not to be confident about.
Yeah, Gareth, how is it that Israel has been allowed to build up a substantial nuclear arsenal while standing completely to one side of all of the treaty processes surrounding nuclear weapons, and indeed to be able to pretend officially that it doesn't have nuclear weapons? I mean, how has this been allowed?
Well, it does defy credibility, and I think the only reason it's been allowed over the years is because of a sense, not just from successive United States administrations, but others, that if there's an overt acknowledgement of Israel's nuclear capability, it would prove politically impossible for some of its Arab neighbours to avoid, you know, following suit. They'd have to satisfy their own domestic constituencies by not allowing that to happen. That's a pretty implausible sort of response these days when it's so universally acknowledged that Israel is and has been for many decades now a nuclear power. How you describe them getting away with it is a very good question. But certainly it's universally acknowledged in the analytical literature that they're a fully-fledged nuclear-armed state like the other eight we now have.
And what's your prediction for the ultimate outcome of the bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities?
Well, there's obviously the prospect that Iran will believe that it now has no option whatsoever but to race for a bomb, and it is only a few months away from doing that, even with the destruction of some of its facilities and some of its fissile material, presumably. I think I'm less pessimistic about that happening than I was not so long ago. I think the reality is such is the degree of intelligence penetration of the Iranian system by Israel in particular, such is the degree of probability that anything that Iran did to start moving physically towards building a bomb, such is the probability that would be greeted immediately by yet another major military attack by Israel, possibly supported by the US, that I think it is a bit unlikely. I should say about Iran, I've been working on the Iran brief for a long, long time, or I did work during my active years when I was particularly at the International Crisis Group in the first decade of the century. I spent a lot of time being a kind of a back channel between Iran and the United States in the developing concept of what became the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which the US unfortunately later tore up. It was an environment in which the United States wasn't talking to Tehran at all, and in which the Europeans were talking to Tehran but weren't listening. And the reality was that I never really believed, after having a lot of conversations with senior Iranian players, I never really believed that they were actually committed to acquiring a weapon. Certainly they wanted to be seen to be having that capability. Certainly they wanted to be able to thumb their noses at the US and say, yes, don't assume that we can't. But they knew always the downside risks that were involved. And there was also a sort of a religious dimension to it, which has been sort of underappreciated, I think. If we've got a second, I can tell you a story which I think is very revealing in that respect. I was in Tehran having dinner with a group of senior officials, including a little whiskery, Revolutionary Guard character sitting beside me, frayed shirt collar and all the rest. And he was wheezing his way through the dinner. And I said to him at one stage, you don't sound very well. And he said, well, I'm not very well because I was gassed by the Iranians during the recent war. And not wanting to miss an opportunity to make a point, I said, well, under those circumstances, you can't possibly want to be again in a position of not having a similar weapon of mass destruction of your own to ensure that you're not subject to that kind of assault. And instead of just taking that as the kind of debating point that it was, this little guy got incredibly angry, just really genuinely angry, not theatrically angry, but genuinely angry, saying, you don't understand, you and the West don't understand. The fatwa that's been announced by our leaders reflects the reality that God Almighty, Allah bless his name, finds it absolutely unconscionable that we should ever be guilty of using or threatening to use such an outrageously inhumane weapon. And there's little echoes of this periodically over the years, but people have not given, I think, credit to that. Such has been the enthusiasm for demonising the Iranians at every possible step.
Yeah. Why hasn't the Albanese government signed and ratified the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons? Albanese said he was going to. Why hasn't it happened?
Well, the reality is to do so would immediately mean, in effect, the end of the US-Australia alliance as it presently stands, because the Nuclear Ban Treaty, the TPNW, Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, bans absolutely its treaty members from doing anything at all to assist a nuclear weapons power in the management or operation of its nuclear weapons system. And of course, we're up to our eyeballs in assisting the US in that respect, traditionally through the Pine Gap facility, which is highly relevant for intelligence gathering, targeting, and God knows what else. in a nuclear warfare context. But also increasingly, of course, now with the AUKUS arrangement, where there's multiple other layers of very visible assistance to the American nuclear warfighting capability, which we're getting ourselves ever more immersed in. So for all the grandeur of our commitment as a party to signing and ratifying the treaty, it's never really been very plausible that we would. I should say that the treaty itself is far more sort of aspirational than operational. It's got all sorts of flaws in terms of its lack of verification provisions, its lack of enforcement provisions, the time-bound constraint that it sets on moving to zero in a way that any cautious nuclear-armed power would be very, very reluctant to commit itself to without the guarantee of effective enforcement against rogue state breakout. There are all sorts of problems with the treaty, and I think it is a bit regrettable that we pretended to completely support it while always knowing that the price of actually supporting it, actually signing it, actually ratifying it would be to tear up the defence alliance with the United States. And while some people might still want to argue to this day that that's something wholly to be desired, it's a hell of a big step to take in the context of buying into a treaty which, frankly, is of not much operational utility at all, even though it is intellectually, normatively, morally an important step forward.
But would any treaty, if word came that a missile was on its way, would any treaty hold anybody back from retaliating?
Well, if they retain their weapons, have that capacity, and there's a weapon on its way, and they're confident in the intelligence, which is a big ask as to where the weapon came from and what its impact is likely to be, no, it's not going to hold them back. But there is a sense in which treaties are not worthless. There is a very strong, imperative in international relations, if you have actually bought into a treaty, to be prepared to observe its constraints. And one of the reasons why the Americans have not actually signed the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, even though up until now at least they've been strong supporters of it, is that they know that to sign it would be to be absolutely constrained, and even under sort of Trumpian-type administration, that does seem to be something of an inhibition.
Even though, as you said a moment ago, we're up to our necks in this, you argue that it would be possible for Australia to exert some soft power, at least, to try to fix some of the dangers here. How?
Well, we've done that in the past. I mean, under the Keating government at the end of that period, we did establish the Canberra Commission on the abolition of elimination of nuclear weapons. And that was the first really big international enterprise in establishing clearly the problems associated with nuclear weapons retention by anyone, with that famous mantra that we articulated that, so long as any state has nuclear weapons, others will want them. So long as anyone has them, they're likely one day to be used, if not deliberately, then by accident, misadventure. And any such use would be catastrophic for life on this planet as we know it. That was a very big normative step forward, and that was driven wholly by Australia. Again, we've played a big role in the extension permanently of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Richard Butler, of blessed memory, as our ambassador, was very, very effective internationally in making that happen. We played a big role under the Howard government, I have to acknowledge, in getting the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty out of a rut in which it was stuck in Geneva into the UN General Assembly and actually being there formally endorsed. We played under the Rudd administration a significant role in with the establishment of the International Commission, the Australia-Japan Commission on Nuclear Non-Proliferation Disarmament, which I co-chaired with my former foreign minister counterpart from Japan. And that was an important step forward in articulating for the whole world a course of action in terms of nuclear risk minimization, which, had its obvious policy attractions and utility. So we've been there in the past. We've been significant players with our voice taken seriously, and we can be again. How much difference it would make in terms of the actual big goal of global zero, getting rid of nuclear weapons completely, is, of course, arguable, but that's no reason for our voice not being heard. In terms of continuing to support non-proliferation to new players in the scene and all the things that are necessary to create a competing dynamic to that. Our voice is very important, has always been important, always been listened to in that context. And in terms of nuclear risk reduction, I think we have a particularly important role to play when it comes to doing perhaps what I've argued would be the most useful single thing to generate nuclear risk reduction, and that is to get universal embrace of a principle of no first use. And in the past, Australia has not been helpful in advancing that cause when, as I might have mentioned, Obama and Biden were keen to go down that particular path.
But we didn't back them.
No, we didn't back them any more than the European allies wouldn't back them and our Northeast Asian allies and partners of the US wouldn't back them. They wanted to keep open the option of first use, God help us. But Australia's voice, had it been heard then loudly and clearly, as I hope it will be in the future, would have been hugely relevant in giving the Americans some confidence that they could go down that path without generating adverse consequences. So in all of that, I've also argued in this paper that it really would be helpful in respect if Albo, as Prime Minister, were to take the opportunity to make a really big speech, not in the not-too-distant future, bringing together all these threads, explaining why it is that this is still such a critically troubling issue, and explaining what it is that we as Australians can possibly do to reduce the risks that are involved.
If not to,
big conceptual speeches of that kind don't seem to be our present government's forte, but they do matter in changing the community sense of what's important and generating an impression for us internationally of the kind of good international citizen role that we have played very successfully in the past.
Gareth, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure, David.
I've been talking to Gareth Evans, who these days is Distinguished Honorary Professor of the Australian National University and author of a paper in Australian Foreign Affairs, Doomsday Diplomacy, Australia Can Lead a New Arms Control Push, and Australian Foreign Affairs, of course, is up there available online. This is Late Night Live.